stop, to shake hands, to take a little of that bright, jittering energy for herself. But Drummer and Laughlin didn't pause. There was still some decorum that came with rank. The executive waiting area was well appointed with bulbs of coffee or liquor, living plants in wall gardens, soft music and LEDs that matched the spectrum of the morning light in early spring. Or so they told her. It wasn't as if spring were a concept with any practical existence in her life. It was nice, anyway. Avasarala floated in a white sari with a golden sash. Drummer admired the old woman's ability to wear it and remain decent. It wasn't something a lot of Earthers could manage. She touched Laughlin's shoulder. "You'll excuse me." "Of course, Madam President," he said. "I look forward to seeing you at the post-action debrief."
"You too," Drummer said.
Avasarala nodded as Drummer slid close, braced on a handhold to kill her momentum.
"You're leaving too?"
Avasarala asked, her voice carefully neutral.
"No," Drummer said. "I live here."
"You're a fucking idiot," the old woman sighed. "But you'd be one if you left, too. It'd be a better world if there was always at least one right answer instead of a basket of fucked."
"Are you all right?" Drummer asked.
Avasarala waved the comment away, then reached out to the handhold to steady herself.
"I'm trying to decide if we're absolutely certain to lose or absolutely certain to win," she said. "I change my mind every 10 minutes or so."
"It's one ship that hasn't been able to resupply in weeks," Drummer said. "It's already been through a battle. And that turning off people's minds for a while thing it did, we're ready for it this time. The automated systems have their governors off. We may have to get clever before the next one shows up, but no matter what happens, we'll keep firing until that thing is a cloud of complex molecules and regret."
"And because it's this 10 minutes, Avasarala said, "I find that argument persuasive. Next one, I'm going to remember that Duarte sent it, and then I'll get scared."
She shook her head. "Who knows? The son of a bitch has been off in his own private system since before the Free Navy got their nuts handed to them, and it's pretty clear he's been rubbing up against whatever artifacts he found there. Maybe it made him stupid."
"Doesn't change what we have to do," Drummer said.
"It doesn't," Avasarala agreed. "I hate this part."
"You have a clear succession? Santos Baca went down with her ship, too.
And even if you turn that ugly motherfucker of a ship to slag, one of the EMC bastards is likely to throw something the wrong direction. If this goes badly, the last thing we're going to need is a long, angry committee meeting with everyone saying they've got the conk."
Drummer felt a blaze of annoyance, but pushed it down. The old woman wasn't trying to be insulting. She was just flailing around, trying to find something she still had control over.
"We have bylaws," Drummer said, "and it won't matter. If I eat a stray torpedo, Albin Nazari takes over."
"That Reiner?
He's just gotten used to Santos Baca's chair, and then he gets yours, too? He'd be like a 5-year-old driving a mech loader."
"I'll be dead," Drummer said, "so I won't give a fuck."
Avasarala's laugh was short, surprised, and joyful.
"I don't hate you, Kamina. I hate almost everyone these days, but I don't hate you."
"I'm not planning to put Nazari in charge," Drummer said. "I'm planning to win."
In the scheme of the battle, people's home was many things. Battleship, medical facility, port and resupply. It was all the things a city could be. In the display, it was slightly paler than the other green dots that were its fellows.
guard of passage, had a position that mirrored it. The two great cities of the Union, with their drums spun down, burning into the fight as anchors for the fleet. Cities that had become battleships.
"Coffee?" Vaughn asked, and Drummer waved him away. The control room was lit like a theater, dim and warm with a tactical display and a multi-networked holographic output. Drummer had been in other battles. She had studied more than that. She had never seen more firepower leveled at a single target. She was fairly certain it had never happened before. She strapped herself into her crash couch, checked the juice. The chances were very slim that People's Home would go on the burn, but if it did, she'd be ready. The whole sphere of battle was less than 3 light seconds across. 850,000 kilometers from the 2 most distant ships in the EMC fleet, a balloon holding 300 quadrillion cubic kilometers of nothing, with a few hundred ships dotting its skin. If she'd been in a vac suit, the drive plumes of the Navy would have been invisible among the stars. It was the most tightly formed major battle in decades, maybe ever, and she wouldn't have been able to see her nearest ally with her naked eye. "The enemy's crossed Lucre Point," the weapons tech said, his voice calm. "Are the EMC ships opening fire?"
"They are, ma'am."
"So let's do two," she said. She wanted there to be a throb of railguns, the chatter of PDC fire, but People's Home was a huge structure. Even as her display told her that the rail guns were firing, the room was silent. Hundreds of other ships were doing the same thing at the same moment. Tens of thousands of tungsten slugs moving at a non-trivial fraction of C. It would be less than a minute before they converged on the Tempest, staggered and spread to make dodging difficult, but not impossible.
"And the enemy is evading," the sensor tech reported, her voice sharp.
"Do we have visual?"
An answer, she put up the live feed. A second's delay, maybe two. Hardly anything at all. They were so close they could have spoken in real time. It made her feel uncomfortable to be so near the Tempest. But there it was, its weirdly organic shape bright in the enhanced colors. Jets of reaction mass gouted from one side, pushing the ship to a slightly different course.
"Correcting for new vector," the weapons station said. "And firing. EMC forces are also launching torpedoes."
"Do the same," Drummer said. She checked the time. 3 minutes had passed. She took control of the visual display, zooming in on the skin of the enemy ship. It didn't look like it had plating so much as a single textured surface. She threw on the tactical overlay, and a dozen points appeared that weren't visible in reality. The high-value targets, the vulnerable places on the Tempest that didn't grow back, or at least not quickly. A dozen carefully placed dots that Emily Santos Baca and Independence had died to find.
"Come on," she said, willing the missiles to strike.
"The enemy is firing PDCs," the sensor tech said.
"Show me," Drummer said.
And the Tempest almost vanished in a cloud of tracers. The data field was too rich to comprehend. Missiles, streams of PDC fire, the straight-line paths of the railgun rounds.
"EMC battleship Frederick Lewis is reporting damage," Vaughn said.
"Are you working comms now?" Drummer asked. "Who's going to get me my coffee?"
"They're dropping core," Vaughn said, ignoring her.
A little cheer went up, and it took Drummer half a second to see why. One of the hard points on the Tempest was blinking, the system reporting a missile strike that had connected with the target. The cloud of PDC fire grew a degree thinner. Any ship Drummer knew, any station she'd ever heard of, would have been reduced to slivers of metal and flakes of lace by now. The only thing she could think of that would withstand that barrage was a planet. Even then, cities would have been pounded to dust by what had been launched in the last 15 minutes. 16 now. It was so fast. There should have been hours between launch and response, but this wasn't that kind of battle. There was no finesse to it, just brutal, constant violence. The tightness in her throat was the memory of Pallas. The harder they pushed the Tempest, the more Drummer feared the magnetic beam. If the Laconians used it on people's home, she wouldn't live long enough to notice she was being ripped apart. And if the glitch happened again, well, the observatories on Earth and Mars might get more data about how long it took the enemy to recharge the damn thing. But they hadn't used it yet. Maybe the time slip had been the fucking thing breaking. The universe owed her a little slice of luck like that. Another 2 hits on the Tempest. It shifted, plumes of steam appearing from its thrusters as it evaded incoming fire. 5 more of the EMC ships took crippling damage or turned to bright dust, too far away to see. The Tempest veered and danced. Dark streaks marked its sides where the missiles and railgun rounds hit, and while most of the marks faded, not all of them did. "We have expended 2/3 of our railgun ammunition," the weapons tech announced. "Shall I maintain fire?" "Yes," Drummer said. "Then start putting chairs in the launcher. We hit that thing until we're down to pillows and beer." "Understood, ma'am," the weapons tech said. She could hear the smile in his voice. She felt it, too, the giddy sense that even if they were winning ugly, they were at least winning. On the display, the Tempest shifted and dodged like a fish in a tank. The organic curves of its design made it hard not to think of it as an animal. An apex predator, surprised to find itself outmatched by its prey. And there was something. "On the aft, by that 3rd contact point, is that a gas plume?" The sensors tech shifted through 6 slices of the spectrum in less than a second. "That is correct, ma'am. The Tempest appears to be venting atmosphere. EMC Governor Knight is launching high-yield nuclear torpedoes," Vaughn said. Drummer sat back in her crash couch. Anticipation was a tightness in her throat and her hands. The Tempest's PDCs weren't all disabled. There was still the chance it might kill the nukes before they got close enough to detonate. Seconds stretched into minutes. Her neck ached from straining toward the display. The light of the explosion whited out the sensor array. A ragged cheer came from all around the control room. "One down," she said to herself, "and fuck you all along with it." It wasn't over. Laconia would send another ship after this one, a fleet next time. The Union and the EMC would have to get much more clever. But they knew more now, about how the enemy ships functioned, how they maneuvered in battle, and, most important of all, how they could be killed. And she had to expect reprisals. By deciding to send her one last desperate message, she had as good as told the Laconians that she still had allies on Medina. The choice had seemed like the right and obvious thing at the time. She'd pointed at Medina and said, "Look for my people here." It might be the thing that killed Saba and his crew. It was a problem for another day. A tragedy she'd face when she could do something about it, and not before. There was too much that had to be done here and now. "Send the return signal to all the transport ships and get the docks ready to bring everyone home," she said. "It's going to be a long couple weeks, people. We may as well get to it." Another cheer, this one louder. They'd all been so hungry for a win, they were drunk with it. She was, too.
Ma'am, the sensor tech said, the word like a drop of ice in a sauna. The sensors had finished their reset. The Tempest was still where it had been, not scattered into atoms. An eerie blue mottling danced in lines like veins under the ship's skin, bright but fading. The EMC's nukes might not have made contact before they detonated, but the fireball should have been enough to kill anything, or at least anything that Drummer knew of.
"It's firing missiles, ma'am," the sensor tech said.
They'd known. Laconia had known they'd be facing nuclear torpedoes. And now everyone on all the colony worlds would see that even that wasn't enough to kill their ships. Maybe that had been the point all along.
"Tactical," she said. "Get me tactical."
The display jittered and shifted. The orange dot was now deep in the cup they'd created to destroy it, and it was still not destroyed. Even with its tactical maneuvering, its course toward the inner planets hadn't shifted. All around it, bright green dots were blinking out.
Chapter 43. Naomi. The scratch came in the middle of the third shift. If Naomi had been able to sleep, it would have been her midnight. But she was in her bunk, staring into the darkness and waiting for something she knew wouldn't come. So she heard it, fingernails against the access door that led to the corridor. It was softer than a knock, but it meant the same thing. "I'm here. Let me in." She sat up. Her body ached like she'd worked out too hard, but it was just stress and fatigue. She pulled herself up, opened her door as Bobby across from her opened her own. Bobby was wearing a tight jumpsuit, the kind you'd put on under a vac suit, or, she supposed, power armor. She nodded to Naomi, but didn't speak. They were both being quiet for the others, Amos and Alex and Clarissa. The ones who could sleep, maybe. Someone ought to. Bobby opened the door to the public corridor. Katria wore the uniform of the Medina maintenance crew, green, with a station logo printed on the shoulders and back. A ceramic toolbox rested on the deck by her left foot. Gray, where it wasn't scratched white by long use. Naomi guessed there was enough explosive in it to kill all of them so fast they wouldn't know they were dead until the funeral. Katria's nonchalance with it was like a boast. Voltaire Collective had always been like that, even back in ancient days when Earth and Mars had ruled the solar system and no one had ever heard of Protogen. Every revolution needed its mad bombers, apparently.
"Tug," Katria said to Naomi, then to Bobby, "you ready to play a game?"
Bobby put her hand on Naomi's shoulder.
"Take care of the kids until I get back."
"I will," Naomi said. "Good hunting."
"Thanks," Bobby said.
Katria stood aside and let the big woman pass. The emptiness on Bobby's face could have read as indifference to someone who didn't know her. To someone who didn't understand the kinship that Bobby felt to Mars and its military, and to those who had served once and then been forced by conscience or circumstance to walk away.
"Bobby," Naomi said, "I'm sorry."
Bobby nodded. That was all. An acknowledgement that they both understood the situation and would do what needed to be done. Katria plucked the toolbox up and the two of them walked away down the corridor. Naomi closed the door behind them. Back in her bunk and sleepless, she wondered what Jim would have done. Something idealistic and impulsive that would lead to more complications, probably. Certainly.
And he would have done it in a way that kept that expression off Bobby's face, if he could. Even if it meant doing something terrible to himself. Like languishing in a Laconian brig. An image came to her mind of Jim being tortured, and she pushed it away. Again. Feeling fear and sorrow would come later. When they were done. When he was back. There'd be time for it then. She didn't manage actual sleep, but she was able to drift a little before the shift change. It was enough to let her feel rested, but not deeply. She met Saba at the same public counter where they'd used the freezer, but this time they sat at the front like customers. The girl behind the counter turned up the music playing from her system speakers loud enough that they could barely hear each other. Their words drowned in drums and strings and ululating voices. Saba looked as tired as she felt. "Something happening back in Sol System," he said. "Looks like a big fight. Not sure how it's going to play." Half a dozen possibilities flashed through her sleep-starved mind, ranging from the miraculously good to the catastrophically bad. It didn't matter. Nothing that happened there changed what they were doing here. But Saba's wife was there, back in the empty spaces where they'd all lived once upon a time. She knew too well what that fear felt like. "You have the list?" she asked. Saba nodded and pressed a silver memory chip into her hand. "All the ships we could make contact with," he said. "How many?" 21. Naomi nodded. 21 ships docked on Medina and waiting for their chance to load up and fly. It was more than she'd hoped for. It was also enough to pose some problems. "I don't like having this many people knowing what's going on." "It's a risk," Saba said, as if he were agreeing with something she'd said. "How does it make us for time? If you don't mind half of them vanishing in transit, we can go pretty fast," Naomi said, more sharply than she'd intended. She shook her head, apologizing, but Saba ignored both the snappishness and the regret for it. "Say we don't. Everyone through the gate safe and sound. What does that look like?" "I can't know that until I look at the ship profiles. Mass, drive type, cargo. All of that's going to make a difference." "Ballpark?" 100 minutes. That's conservative. I can probably find a way to make it less." The girl at the counter swung past, pouring fresh tea into their glasses. Tiny bits of mint leaf swirled in the reddish amber. Naomi took a sip while Saba scowled. "That's a long time for the station's eyes to stay blind. And a lot to lose if they find a way to put it back together." "Truth," Naomi said. Saba scratched his chin with the back of his hand. If they ever played poker together, it was a gesture she'd remember. His tell. "Your technician. The one to break the system?" "Clarissa." "Her, yeah. If she doesn't do the thing and do it well, everyone on those ships is going to die from trusting me. Not disrespect, but it's mine to say. Not sure she's good for it." "Clarissa knows what she's doing," Naomi said. "She's smart, she's studied, and she knows this station. She broke it once already." "She's as thin as wire," Saba said. "I could blow her over from whistling." There was no humor in his face. "I trust her with my life," Naomi said. "No hesitation." "You're asking me to trust her with more than that," Saba said. "I don't. Not that she doesn't know, not that she's unwilling or not to trust. But straight between us, sister, putting all of us on one girl just this side of hospital, it's not prudence." "I think you're asking me for something." "You go with her," Saba said. "Leave the prison work to me and mine. We'll do that. You back up your crew." Naomi shook her head. "The prison's mine," she said. "Clarissa will do whatever needs doing. She's got backup already. Jordao, Katria's man. Unless you don't trust him."
"I don't trust anyone," Saba said. "Not him, not her, not you."
"But I work with what I have to work with. And I know you're not going to run when things go harsh. Maybe Katria's people will. Maybe they won't. You won't. And the censors are more important than the prisons. We lose the prisons. We only lose the prisoners, Savisa."
He was right, and she knew it. Putting the success or failure of the mission in the hands of a medically fragile woman, however competent she was, and then not giving her the backup to deal with an emergent problem was bad practice. But in her imagination, Naomi saw the letters on her list as clearly as if she'd been reading them afresh. "Save Jim." She shook her head. "Prison's mine. Sensor arrays are hers. Won't be a problem."
Saba sighed as the music shifted key and tempo. A man's voice, growling like a bearing going bad, lamented his own failings in a mix of Hindi and Spanish that she could almost follow. She looked Saba in the eyes until he looked away.
"Work up a schedule, then. All the ship's data on there, but do it fast. We have to distribute it by hand before we pull the trigger."
2 hours, Naomi said. "I'll have it ready." An hour later, there was still no word from Bobby. No way to check in. They waited in their bunks, the doors open on their little common hallway. Amos stood in the head, leaning against the sink with his arms crossed. Alex sat in the doorway of his cabin. Clarissa stretched out on the deck like a bored teenager waiting for the hours to pass until she could begin living. Her skin was unnaturally smooth and tight. It helped the illusion. Naomi sat in her bunk, hand terminal in her lap, and arranged the flight schedule while they talked.
"I don't know," Alex said. "I mean, sure, it's a risk that there'll be ships waiting on the other side of the gates. There have got to be some queuing up to get to Medina when they don't think they'll get shot at. But if we're only looking at 21 ships...
"I'm only looking at one," Amos said.
"So let's say there's 200 ships waiting to come through," Clarissa said, ignoring him. "High end of plausible, but what the hell, right? That's 1,100 gates with no one standing by close enough to get a really good look at whoever came through. That's still a 15% chance of getting seen."
"That high?" Alex said. "You sure? I thought it'd be less than that."
Naomi went through the data Saba had given her. The old Buncombe, a recent generation transport ship with a high-capacity Epstein drive and a cargo hold full of refined titanium. The Lightbreaker, a three-generation-old yacht salvaged by a semi-governmental courier service. The Rosy Cross, a rehabilitated prospecting ship with 5 previous owners and a drive that leaked enough radiation to cook with. The Han Yu, a privately owned coyote with authorization to carry settlers to the colony worlds. Each ship had its own specs, its own limitations. And each one would have an effect on the ring gates that could make the ship leaving after it vanish into wherever ships went when they went Dutchman. Naomi knew the curve as well as she knew her name. And the hand terminal, limited as it was, had enough native computing power to lay that in. Writing a program to weigh all the variables, evaluate each ship, and create a best speed model wasn't hard, but it took time and focus, neither of which she had in great supply.
"It ain't that high if you're only looking at one ship," Amos said. "You can bend the odds pretty good. I mean, no one's going for Solgate unless they're tired of life. And there's not going to be any ships waiting to come through from Karen or Naraka." If we're down to hiding out in dead systems, Alex began.
Clarissa interrupted him.
We should go to Freehold.
You feeling okay, Claire? Alex asked. You remember we didn't leave on good terms, right? It was even money for a while that they were going to shoot Bobby and Holden before they could get back to the ship.
From where Naomi was sitting, she could see Clarissa's ankles shift around each other as she rolled onto her belly.
No, I'm serious. They're fiercely independent. They were willing to stand up to the transport union, and I don't see them rushing to wave the Laconian flag either. They're underdeveloped enough that there won't be complex local politics, no factions within factions that we don't understand, or at least fewer than you'd get somewhere like Gaon Complex. Plus which, we know there aren't any ships observing the other side of their ring, because we were the only ship in the system, and no one's gone out there since the occupation started.
That Houston asshole was pretty smart, Amos said.
Ah, I see what you're doing, Alex said. You're trying to make flying out to Karen and dodging radiation flares sound like a good idea. It's that whole, I'll put a shitty idea next to a really shitty idea so the first one looks shiny by comparison thing.
I think we should go to Freehold, Amos said. Naomi, you think we should go to Freehold?
Sure, she said, starting the data run.
Seriously?
Alex said.
Her points are all solid, Naomi said. The data run stopped a third of the way through. She ended the process and opened the run logs. We have to get small for a while. Be hard to see. Wait for Laconia to show us where its weak spots are. We'll have to be someplace while that happens.
It might as well be there. But the shooting us part?
Is something we'll need to work through, Naomi said. Hey, those paper uniforms people can get out of the station kiosks? Do you think we could get that to print out sheets?
Like bed sheets?
Alex said.
Something to write on so we can distribute this when I'm done. Can't put it on the system.
Maybe, Amos said. Be kind of weird, though.
The run log looked decent until it started the confirmation routine. Then it hung on something. She grabbed the code reference and went back to the original script. The others were still talking, but her focus on the screen lowered the volume on them. She was aware of Amos's low, gravel-strewn voice, Clarissa, higher and more musical, Alex with the ghost of a Mariner drawl that was more habit than accent, her family. Part of her family. There was a zero result where there should have been a birth number. That was where the code was choking. It probably made sense to just chuck the routine entirely, reaching beyond Saba's secret network, even if it was only for passive information like reading docking records, was a little risky. But building a schedule on unconfirmed data could screw them up as well. She hesitated, pulled the code, then put it back and reopened the logs. The bad entry was the 12th ship in the logs. The Lightbreaker. She tapped her fingers against her thigh. Dig deeper and risk being noticed by security, or ignore the error and move ahead as if everything was as expected. If she'd gotten a little more sleep, it would have been easier to make the decision.
Baranya Uja, son todas son hanged, she said to herself,
and opened a low-level request to the docking records. It only took seconds for confirmation to come through. The Lightbreaker wasn't in its berth. It had shipped out 2 days ago. The flight plan listed the destination as Laconia, with a service code that looked military. Well, that was one less for the evacuation plan. It would make things faster, but Saba would need to know. The crew, if they weren't on the burn for the heart of the enemy, would need other bunks. She looked at the service code, touched it with a fingertip.
Alex,
Did the MCRN have a code 1820SKS?
Sure, he said from the hall. Did a few of those myself way back when. Priority prisoner transfer. Why?
When she'd been about 11, Naomi had been working in a warehouse on Iapetus. A steel support beam had popped its welds and sprung out, clipping the back of her head. It hadn't been pain, not at first, just a feeling of impact, and her senses receding a little. The agony had 2, maybe 3 seconds to clear its throat and straighten its sleeves before it crashed over her. This felt very much the same. Her hand trembled as she looked for a manifest, something to say who'd been on the Lightbreaker, who'd been important enough to the Empire that they'd commandeered a ship just to take them away. There was nothing. Of course there wasn't. Why would the Laconians announce that to anyone? She checked the dates, the times. It didn't have to be Jim. It could have been someone else. But it wasn't. She took a moment for herself and the pain. 5 seconds. She could let herself hurt for 5 seconds. Then she had to get back to work. The rest would be for later. She sent a message, text only, to Saba. The missing ship, the service coding, her suspicion that James Holden was already past the ring gate and into Laconian space. Did Saba have any contacts who could confirm that? After the message sent, she took a deep breath, then another. She pulled the Lightbreaker out of her data set and ran her code again. It didn't hang this time. She got up, surprised by how steady she felt, and took the 2 steps to the door.
"What's the matter, boss?" Amos asked.
Naomi shook her head. When she spoke to Clarissa. "I had a talk with Saba. I'm going with you on the sensor array leg of this." Clarissa's brow was bent by whatever she saw on Naomi's face.
"Okay. Why?"
"Risk management," Naomi said. "If the prison break fails, we don't get as many people out. If the sensors come back up and they're able to track which ships went through which gates, the whole mission fails. Better that we spend our resources where they matter the most." "But if Holden is..." Clarissa began, then went quiet. Naomi watched her understand. "The prisoner transfer." Alex's face was grayish and pale.
"Fuck," he said.
"And we need something to write down the evacuation plan on," Naomi said. "Something small and portable, and not connected to the computer networks at all." Amos pushed himself up from the sink.
"You got it, boss. Give me 20 minutes.
"And something to write with," Naomi said as the big man walked out into the public corridor. Her hand terminal chimed, and she went back to her crash couch. The run was finished. 20 ships, in the order that would get them through the gates and gone at the min-max point of risk and speed. Optimal was 87 minutes, even with the Rocinante looping back to pick up Amos, Bobby, Clarissa, and her. It was a solid plan. She had a solid plan. She pulled up her organizational notes and sat for a moment, looking at the words she'd put there. "Save Jim." She drew a line through them. Chapter 44. Bobby.
"Tug,"
Katria said, then turned to look at her. A ghost of a smile touched the other woman's lips, and Bobby wondered just exactly how much of the violence of their first meeting was really forgotten and forgiven.
"You ready to play a game?"
After half a beat, Naomi's gaze tracked over to her. Exhaustion had yellowed her sclera, and her skin had an undertone of ash. She put a hand on Naomi's shoulder to steady her as much as anything.
"Take care of the kids until I get back."
"I will,"
Good hunting.
The words were a little punch in the gut. Hope you kill someone. Some other Marine who had the bad luck to be born on the wrong side of this. Who's as loyal to his people as you are to yours. Whoever they are, I hope you get them before they get you. The truth of it was, despite everything, there was a joy in this. She'd spent some of the most important years of her young life training for moments like this one, and as much as she wanted to have grown and matured, aged into a woman of peace, part of her still really liked it.
Thanks, Bobby said, and stepped out.
Bobby, I'm sorry.
Bobby nodded as Katria scooped up her toolbox. They walked together toward the intersection with a larger corridor. The door closed behind them with a soft click and the whir of the lock. Katria chuckled under her breath, but Bobby didn't ask why. She didn't much want to know. Most of the people in the corridor were walking, but there were a few carts loaded with containers. At one intersection, a man was driving a loading mech, moving it from one warehouse to another. It was a four-point harness. If she got in by his side, she could loop one arm around his neck and choke him out while she unbuckled him from the controls with the other. Drop him out, swing around, and strap herself in. It would probably take 30 seconds, maybe less. Easy peasy. As they walked, she felt herself relaxing, sinking down into her hips as she walked, lowering her center of gravity. She whistled a little, softly. Katria raised an eyebrow, but didn't comment. The screens along the walls announced that the security forces were closing in on the terrorist cell that had blown up the oxygen tanks. But Bobby didn't see anyone giving the pair of them a second glance, much less closing in. There was a sparseness about the halls. Even with the carts and the people, there was an emptiness showing through. Part of it had to be that, with no ships coming in or out of the station, there just wasn't as much to do as there would have been. But part of it was also fear. People staying in their holes, staying out away from the checkpoints, out of trouble. They took the ramp down, away from the inner surface of the drum. There weren't many places on the drum that came close to the skin of the station. Most of the outer layers had been designed with radiation shielding in mind. Water tanks, storage for ceramic and metal and steriles. Service halls with anti-spalling covered in paint and conduit and pipes. But there were a few junctions near service airlocks where only a few layers of steel and ceramic and foam separated their feet from the outside. It reminded her of being on one of the old Dowager-class battleships. The bare functionality of the design belonged to a different generation from the residential levels or the interface of the drum. The hallway, where Katria stopped, looked just like the sections they'd been walking through. But she checked the section identifiers painted on the walls and the pipes, then stamped her foot on the deck like she was listening for something in the way it rang.
Here? Bobby asked. This is the place. Boost me up.
Bobby locked her fingers together into a cradle, and Katria put her foot into it. She didn't weigh much. Bobby hauled her up toward the ceiling. Could have kept her there for hours, she thought. Katria caressed the ceiling with her palm, then found what she was looking for, pressed hard enough that Bobby felt it, and slid a panel aside. A little gap, hardly more than a decimeter, between the panel and the structural beam above it. Katria hoisted her toolbox, checked its orientation, and slid it into place. She pulled the ceiling tile back and tapped Bobby on the shoulder to be put down.
That's it?
No, Katria said, and pulled a bit of black tape from her pocket. After a moment's consideration, she curled it around a bit of pipe just beside the bomb then took her hand terminal out and shifted to a screen Bobby had never seen before. A rough, grainy image of the hallway appeared on it, including her and Katria from the tape's perspective. Katria stood directly under the bomb, then tapped her own image on the screen. Red script came up, locked, and she put the terminal back in her pocket. "Now, that's it," she said. "Okay," Bobby said. "Let's go outside." The maintenance airlock was uncrewed. Two vac suits hung in the lockers, a large gray transport box with its lid open and unsealed, and inside of that, a yellow ceramic box beside them with Zemitor stenciled on it in black. The transport box wheels were retracted, the steering handle stowed on its side. The walls and lid were only a little thicker than the real thing. Whatever they were using for shielding, it was thin. She hoped it was light, too. Bobby put on the environment suit, checked her seals and air supply. She and Katria checked each other. The suit had a magnetic tether built into it, a ribbon as wide as her hand and thick as her pinky, dirty from years of use. The airlock itself was set into the floor. The little platform to carry them out to the drum's surface and hopefully not fling them out into the emptiness of the slow zone. With both of them and the box, it was a tight fit. Bobby watched the suit's sleeve puff out a little as the lock cycled out the air. Katria pressed her helmet against Bobby's and shouted. With only physical conduction to carry the sound, her voice was distant and muffled. "Last chance to back away." Bobby smiled and made an obscene gesture. She could see Katria laughing, but she couldn't hear it. The lock cycled, and the platform descended. The body of Medina's drum curved away above her to the left and right, extended ahead of her and behind. She felt like she was hanging on to the belly of some massively vast whale. The gates were only pinpoints of eerie and erratic light, as regular as a printed pattern against the surreal darkness below her. The gates and the tiny dot of the alien station in the center of ring space. It wasn't her first time outside a ship in the slow zone, but she shuddered all the same. Falling off a spin station in normal space meant drifting out at whatever velocity the station had given her until someone came to haul her back or she ran out of air. Losing her connection here meant falling into the blackness between the gates and vanishing into whatever existed or failed to exist on the other side. Normal, star-strewn space could feel like an infinite ocean, vast and glorious and uncaring. The slow zone felt like being in something's mouth. Katria put her safety tether on the surface of the drum, then lay on her back and pushed her feet up until her mag boot locked to the station. Bobby waited to follow until she'd taken a couple of awkward, swaying steps. And then she was also hanging upside down from the turning station. The crate in her hand wanted to fly up like the loop of her safety harness. Blood rushed into her head, filling her ears with their own distant roar as they walked, release, swing, push up, and reconnect to the station, back along until they found the stretch of plating that would become the breach point. Katria gestured to the crate, two fingers pointing, the belter's gesture for opening or deploying. Bobby nodded yes with a closed fist. The mining net was a square of woven steel cable, reinforced by carbon fiber. Rock hoppers and subsistence miners had been using things like it since humanity had first crawled up the well and started harvesting the near-Earth asteroids. The primary piton was thicker than Bobby's thigh. She fastened it to the skin of the station, then waited for a moment as the external elevator shaft that ran along the drum from engineering to the command center passed overhead. She and Katria took different edges, pulling and stretching the net as they navigated around the target, placing the secondary pitons until the whole thing lay like a low, black blister on the side of the drum. The trap set at last. Katria dropped the box, and it flew up and away into the darkness, gone in an eye blink. She led the way back almost to the airlock platform, then turned off one mag boot, and then the other, and swung on her safety harness, feet to the void. Bobby did the same. It felt better to be right side up again, and worse to know that only one failure point was keeping her alive. Trade-offs. There were always trade-offs. Katria slaved her hand terminal to the suit's arm display, copied the output to Bobby's, and set up a low-power radio connection between them. The corridor where they'd set the bomb appeared in the same grainy, muted colors as before. Empty for now, but not forever. "Now we wait," Katria said through the radio. "The patrol puts their foot in our trap, or someone notices that we're out here."
"Yeah," Bobby said.
"Don't worry. These Laconians are just like Earthers. They only think of ships and stations as inside. Comes from growing up in free air.
The predictable limits of a conceptual framework," Bobby said, a phrase from her classroom on Olympus Mons. "It's always where to hit the enemy, whoever they turn out to be. When I learned how to do things like this, we were thinking about Earthers and pirates."
Katria laughed. "When I taught myself how to do this, I was thinking of people like you. Strange how the wheel turns." The elevator passed above them again, the glowing orb of the alien station at the slow zone's heart appearing like a moon on her left, vanishing again on the right. Bobby turned to look toward the docks. The Rocinante was down there somewhere. Her home, and her ship, or Holden's, or neither of theirs. Strange how the wheel turns. The minutes stretched, became hours. Twice people passed through the corridor. A pair of electrical technicians, a sketchy-looking young woman pulling a child by the hand and looking over her shoulder as she walked. Bobby wondered what the story was there, but it wasn't hers. Her anxiety slowly faded into a kind of dull anticipation, and then to both at the same time. The void passed beneath her feet again, and again, and again. She switched her air to the secondary bottle.
"Ah," Katria said. "Here we go."
On the monitor, two people walked down the hall toward the camera. Bobby couldn't mistake the Laconian power armor for anything else. The patrol they'd been waiting for. The enemy approaching. Without a word, she swung back, set her feet against the station, and re-engaged her mag boots. The spin gravity would try to straighten her legs, but that was exactly the wrong thing. She bent double, put her hands behind her knees, and held herself there. Katria did the same, bat-brace position. It was hard to relax like that, especially knowing what was coming. She took a deep breath, starting in her belly and moving through her whole chest, then let it out. Shook her shoulders to get out the tension. Smooth and loose. That was the way to be. She remembered the young Marine she'd flirted with when the Laconians had first taken the station. She wondered if he was on one of the patrols walking above her now, the soles of his feet unknowingly against her own.
"Your turn now, my turn later," she thought.
The seconds stretched. The temptation to shift her arm so she could look at the screen was almost irresistible. The station hit the bottoms of her feet like a hammer. Her legs slammed into her chest, blowing the air out of her. One mag boot threw an error, but only for a second. Then it was done. She turned, walking fast toward the net. It wasn't a low blister anymore. It was a hemisphere of debris and cables, bent, plating, shredded foam, and at the heart of it, trapped like two fish hauled out of a tank, human figures. Above her, the debris small enough to escape the net seemed to fly away from her, though it was really her spinning away from it.
"Hurry," Katria said. "They'll already be on their way."
"I know," Bobby said. At the net, they undid one of the pitons, opening it like the mouth of a tent. The gaping hole that led up into the station leaked water and coolant out, flying down past them as they hung. The nearer of the two bodies had taken the worst of the explosion, a crack along the collar and chest assembly. The inside of the helmet was a soup of blood. Bobby wrestled the corpse closer, holding the arms and waist in a rescue hold while Katria fastened grips to the Laconian suit.
"Hold still," Katria said.
The low-power radio made her voice seem farther away than she was.
"I'm doing my best," Bobby said through clenched teeth. "All right. He's solid."
"You're sure?"
"Positive," Katria said, and disengaged the primary piton.
The net pulled free and fell away below them into nothing. Bobby turned, forcing herself back to the airlock, her muscles burning from the effort. 20 years ago, they wouldn't have been. The spin of the station made it feel like the dead Marine was pulling her down toward the depths, or else up into the emptiest sky in the universe. The power armor helmet knocked against the back of hers. The dead arms and legs hung loose. Blood leaked from the crack in the chest plate.
"I hope this suit's not too fucked up," Bobby said.
"Hope later," Katria said.
"Walk now."
At the platform, Bobby shifted her weight and the dead Marine's with a cry of effort loud enough that Katria turned off her radio. She hung from her safety tether and motioned Bobby up. There wasn't room on the platform for all three of them. Bobby didn't even nod, just turned the controls and the platform rose. While the air cycled in, she sat across from the armor. Her heart was pounding. Her muscles ached. She'd just killed two of the enemy. There would always be a little something, that tug on her humanity that came from doing violence. There was a satisfaction, too. It didn't mean she was a good woman or a bad one. It meant she was a Marine. Somewhere in the station right now, security forces and maintenance techs were scrambling to figure out whether the hole in the station or the possibility of rushing into more bombs was the greater threat. By the time they came to a decision, she needed to be as far away from here as possible. The inner airlock door cycled open, and she hauled the corpse up into the locker room before she cycled the airlock again for Katria to use. When she popped her helmet seals, the dead man stank of blood and overheated metal and the same kind of lubricant she used on Betsy's joints. She pulled the body into the large gray transport box, closed the lid, and triggered the seals. Whatever alerts, whatever alarms the power armor had been sending out were blocked now. Or, if Saba was wrong, she and Katria would find out soon enough. The airlock cycled open while Bobby was pulling off her environment suit. Her jumpsuit was drenched in sweat. Katria undid the seals of her own helmet and slung it into the locker.
"You get the package to Saba," Katria said.
"I know the plan. I'm on it," Bobby said.
and thank you. I know we didn't get off on the right foot, your crew and mine.
No need for that, Katria said, popping the seals on her suit with the speed of long habit. Just get the work done.
Copy that.